Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this second annual Great Debate at Sacred Heart University. Wonderful attendance. People are still coming in, but we really need to get the debate going. What I'm going to do is just briefly set the context and then pass it immediately over to the moderator, Dr. Gary Rose, of our chair of our Department of Government. You know, a year ago when we came up with this idea, the whole intention was to set up a framework where students and guests of the university, faculty and staff, could see a vibrant, engaged conversation and debate amongst members of the faculty. And we wanted to do this so we could model ways in which you can debate. It's possible to hold a position aggressively. It's possible to defend it tenaciously without vituperation or attack or our ad hominem argument. We did it, I think, quite successfully last year, and I'm sure this will be stellar this evening. There is a wonderful line quoted by John le Carré. Some of you may know him. He's a famous former British MI6 spy, but he's most famous as a spy novelist. The Spy Who Came In From the Cold and Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, all these marvelous works. And he said at one point, I'm quoting him, "You can't do mob oratory with the voice of reason, because the devil always has the best lines." Well, the devil is not going to have the best lines tonight. Those best lines are going to be with our four debaters. So please welcome Dr. Gary Rose, the chair and moderator for tonight's debate.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Higgins. As he noted, this is now the second in a series of great debates taking place on the campus of Sacred Heart University. We began this, what hopefully is now a tradition, last year when Professor Higgins and I debated the wall of separation between church and state. I won that debate, by the way. Yep.
Okay. Fake news.
Vituperation already?
But we have a great debate lined up for you tonight. It's a very contentious issue. It's in the center, certainly, of the unfolding presidential campaign, and that is capitalism versus socialism. What is best for America? Representing capitalism, on the side there, we have Professor Bert Spivak and also Professor Lucian Orlowski. Rather than go through all of their biographies, we have summaries of them that have been handed out, because otherwise that would take up about 15 to 20 minutes to read all of their accomplishments. And representing the side of socialism, we have Professor Amanda Morris from sociology, and we have Professor Bill Usman from the School of Communications. Before we begin, I would like to note just one slight error on the bios. I was admonished for not noting that Professor Spivak, in addition to having a Juris Doctorate degree, is also a PhD in history. So I want to just make note of that here. But we're about ready to begin now. And on my left here is our timekeeper, Matt Weiskiel. He's a senior in computer science, and he's more than happy to help me moderate tonight with the time. So we're going to get going now, and I'd like to call upon the first speaker, who's going to represent the side of capitalism, for a four-minute presentation.
Thank you. I feel like Roger Bannister, for those of you who didn't catch that. History offers the best defense of capitalism. The first entry for the word capital appears in the Oxford English Dictionary in 1630, accumulated wealth reproductively employed. That's the place to begin to understand capitalism's success story, an astounding increase in human economic productivity that began about three centuries ago. Until then, both constant toil and grinding poverty were the lot of most of humanity. In the 1,000 years in Europe between 700 and 1700, per capita income grew at 0.1% per year, only doubling every six plus centuries. Economic stagnation was the worldwide order of things. Why was this the case? Incredibly low economic productivity. There were two paths to increase productivity to solve the problem of poverty of the many: the capitalist path, private property, individual economic decision-making, a free economy; the socialist path, socially owned property, central planning, collective decision-making, a command economy. Much of the world, and certainly the United States, chose capitalism, and the historical record of economic growth is astonishing. 97% of all the wealth created in human history was created in the last 250 years. More importantly, and this is the second reason for capitalism's success, this increased productivity was widely shared. Never in a 300-year period in the world did the material conditions of average men and women more dramatically improve. In a little more than a century and a half, in 19th and 20th century America, per capita income increased 18-fold, nothing approaching that had ever occurred before in human history. How wrong was Karl Marx about the possibility of human uplift through capitalism? His expectation was capitalism would exploit workers to their pauperization, leading to an army of unemployed, then revolution, then the collapse of the capitalist order. But the opposite happened. Workers received more and more, not less and less. Take two metrics in the United States. First, the labor share of total economic output according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. In 1946, 66% went to labor. In 2002, 65% went to labor. Take the labor share of total corporate income. In 1984, 77.5% went to labor. In 2015, the same percentage. And not only workers, but consumers. The story of capitalism and the consumer is the story of wide consumer choice and falling prices because of innovation and productive efficiency. Cartels and trusts, legal and illegal, were formed by big business to arrest falling prices, not to increase prices. Most antitrust petitions filed in state and federal courts complained about artificially low prices, not high prices.
1 minute.
The price of the first Model T in 1908 was $890. The price of the 1924 version was $290. In 1900, 2,500 cars were sold in the United States. By 1925, Henry Ford had sold 12 million cars, many to his workers, whom he paid double the prevailing rate. That is why a French sociologist proclaimed that what Marx dreamed, Ford achieved. Today, there are 126 million households in the United States. 90% have one or more cars. 90% are connected to the internet. 96% have one or more TVs.
Time.
Just 15 seconds.
Now. That's 15 4 seconds. Minutes?
That's 4 minutes, right. Let's bring closure to it.
That couldn't have been 4 minutes. Okay.
Okay, thank you very much. I call upon the first speaker for socialism.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Amanda, and my esteemed opponents. It's my honor to have been invited to speak to you today. And I want to be very clear. I'm a socialist. I consider myself a socialist. But for everybody who's here live in the room with us, I want you to note that I do not have horns. I don't have a tail. I'm not a demon or an alien from another civilization. In fact, some people, not all, but some people actually think I'm a nice person. I like kittens and dogs. I even like small children sometimes. Sometimes. And it's because I love children that I consider myself a socialist. I believe capitalism is harmful to children and bad for our future. Now, I should say, I'm not really a socialist because you can't really be a socialist while you live in a capitalist society, but I believe in capitalist principles. I believe in the principle of sharing resources, and that sharing resources is better than just accumulation for yourself or just your own family. But I also want to be clear, I do not support cruel dictators. I don't excuse brutal, totalitarian forms of government. I don't believe in violent revolution. I believe in democracy. Like the historian Kristen Godsey, I use the term democratic socialism to refer to places where socialist principles are championed by parties that compete in free and fair elections and where political rights are maintained. I don't believe in violent revolution because, as the activist and poet John Trudeau has said, I'm not looking to overthrow the American government. The corporate state already has. Socialism is absolutely compatible with a free and open form of democratic government. In fact, it requires that. But capitalism in the long run is incompatible with real freedom and real democracy, because capitalism is incapable of putting in real checks against the undemocratic corporate powers that have taken over our democracy. It is true, as my esteemed opponent said, capitalist growth has produced great wonders. That is true. But it has also, to quote Bhaskar Sunkara, no natural friend of democracy, civic freedom, the environment, or the lives of those it doesn't have a profitable way to exploit. At its core, to be a socialist is to assert the moral worth of every person, no matter who they are, where they're from, or what they did. And I just want to wrap up with a quote from someone that most of you in the room probably admire quite a bit. This is the quote. As we talk about where do we go from here, we must honestly face the fact that the movement must address itself to the question of restructuring the whole of American society.
1 minute.
There are 40 million poor people here. And one day we must ask the question, why are there 40 million poor people in America? And when you begin to ask that question, you're raising a question about the economic system, about a broader distribution of wealth. When you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalist economy. We're called upon to help the beggars in life's marketplace, but one day we must come to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. It means the question must be asked. When you deal with this, you ask the question, who owns the oil? Who owns the iron ore? You begin to ask the question, why is it that people have to pay water bills in a world that is three-fifths water? Those are words that must be said. And the author of those words? Karl Marx. No, just kidding. Martin Luther King Jr. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I call upon the second speaker, who's going to speak on behalf of capitalism, Professor Orlowski.
As an economist and advocate of capitalism, I have one opening question. How much do you charge for an extra minute? Okay, right to the talking points. Arguments in favor of capitalism over socialism. Capitalism relies on freedom of individuals rather than on a formation of common social goods and on uniformity of social values. So as an individual, you have a freedom of choice. Consumers have a freedom to buy diversified, heterogeneous goods, while in socialism, consumers are forced to uniform social values and choices. Next, freedom of businesses under capitalism. Capitalism has freedom of businesses to produce innovative, diversified goods, which may not be the case in socialism. So my second talking point, capitalism provides rewards for risk-taking in Schumpeterian sense and for productivity. This leads to a large productivity advantage in capitalist countries over socialist economies. Socialism promotes egalitarian society, and therefore innovation is embedded in a capitalist system. Just think about it, how many technology companies we have witnessed created under capitalist conditions in the United States and UK vis-a-vis socialist countries of the former Soviet Union. And much related to it is the fact that capitalism relies on profits of individuals, hopefully in the longer run than short run, while socialism relies mainly on central planning as a mechanism of production and distribution. Socialism relies on quotas and price fixing, frequently at below market prices that entail shortages of goods. Today's Venezuela and President Maduro's totally derailed economy is a very, very good argument in favor of it. Socialism normally relies on state-owned monopolies that drain state subsidies and lead to chronic deficits, while capitalism, of course, relies on competitive markets, having a vast access to international investors, to equity markets, to debt markets, and to competitive bank credit. There is a simple advantage. Capitalism is more conducive to generating income, while socialism focuses on income distribution. But in order to distribute something, you must first produce it. Am I right about it? I do acknowledge that the pure capitalism is unrealistic because we have a segment of a society that just cannot help themselves. These marginalized people should be helped by a state. And I have brought a physical evidence right here, epitomizing the victory of capitalism over socialism. Would you know what this is? Yes, you know it. I mentioned it in my class. There's a piece of the Berlin Wall that I chipped myself 30 years ago. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. I call now on the second speaker, who's going to speak on behalf of socialism.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for having us. And I am not a sports fan, but I believe the capitalists have what we would call home field advantage in this situation. So our job is a little tough here because the reality of capitalism is that it feels mostly fine for most people most of the time. And we're oftentimes kind of protected from its most extreme excesses on a daily basis, ironically by socialist policies. So I want to talk a little bit about that pain, because capitalism causes inequality. It is not an unintended side effect. It is the outcome. It is the intended outcome. And that capitalism hurts some people more than others. Particularly in this country, children bear the burden of poverty. Over 16% of our children in this country live in poverty. That is the highest among any age group. And that poverty is exacerbated by things like region, parental educational level, disability, and race. And in true sociological fashion, I'm a sociologist, if you read my bio, I'm essentially arguing to you that this is a false dichotomy, that this dichotomy of capitalism and socialism really misses the points, because socialist policies have long been used to temper the most extreme effects of capitalism. Example, state banks, workers' compensation, disability rights, public health initiatives, Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, for instance. And many of these policies are hugely popular, so much so that politicians on the right and the left all generally have to stand up and promise you that they're not going to touch their social security before they have any chance of being elected. And this alarmist debate is not new, right? So in 1932, and I have my political science friends over here, when Hoover was campaigning against FDR, right, he called the New Deal fascist, socialist, and said that it would lead America on a march to Moscow. Now, the march, we might be on a march to Venezuela now, but the sentiment is still there. It sounds familiar. And much of the conversation about socialism in the U.S. is really political scare tactics. Donald Trump is running for president against socialism and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And that's the discourse we have right now. And that discourse is meant to scare you. But in fact, the democratic socialism being promoted by many on the left is actually pretty palatable to most people, most especially actually young people, polls are showing us. And while many would convince you the party is moving left, this is actually quite cyclical and resembles more the party of the 1970s prior to a hard move right in the 1980s and 90s. And many of us agree, in fact, the majority of us agree that certain basic industries should not be for profit. And the two that stand out most poignantly in this election are education and healthcare. And while the eschewing of such policies is being sold to us in the language of small responsible government, this is absolutely about the protection of wealth. And as an example of that, if we look at the most recent tax cuts, which by all accounts saved corporations billions of dollars, capital expenditures have been largely flat. And in fact, where we've seen most of that money be spent is buying back stock rather than jumpstarting the capital expenditures that we were promised. And this is not surprising. People with wealth use that wealth to build more wealth. And our hesitancy to tax that wealth makes it impossible for us to build a strong and supportive social welfare system and also maintains that stark distribution of wealth. And perhaps most poignant to consider today, given our location, are the ways in which age-based wealth inequality has increased. Over the past 30 years, the net worth of families aged 65 and older has increased by 68%. You can look at them all in the back. They're right. But families aged 35 and younger has decreased by 25%. And what we might expect is to get worse because federal spending is concentrated in areas that benefit older families while spending on younger families, such as investments in children, is projected to fall. And that's not even getting into growth in net interest payments, which maybe we'll have time for. It's no wonder then that young people are more likely to support socialist policies. They're handed a system that doesn't work for them, and then they're criticized when they can't make it work. Their student loan debt has increased sevenfold in those same 30 years I referenced, and their work is what many call the gig economy, and gigs don't come with health care. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I now call upon the first speaker for capitalism for a 3-minute rebuttal.
Well, my problem.
You can, would you pass the mic over?
I think
we don't have a mic.
I think a capitalist took it.
My polite problem with the two socialist debaters is they're not really defending socialism. You know, there's a wide range within the capitalist parliamentary system about what money should be spent and where it should be spent, what priorities should be made and how they should be achieved. But socialism doesn't mean that. Socialism does not work within the context of individual freedom, decision-making, parliamentary regimes, and private property. It works within the system of collectivization and central planning to the detriment of individual decision-making. So while we can debate whether we are liberals or conservatives within the parliamentary capitalist order, that's not the debate tonight. The debate is between what is the best system to maximize human happiness and human growth and human freedom? Is it based on individual decision-making and private property, or is it based on collective will, the diminution of the individual, social planning, collective decision-making? In theory, socialism may sound fine, but we have to deal with it in practice. In practice, it's been the Soviet Union, it's been Cuba, it's been North Korea, it's been China. And China is the perfect example because the dictatorial regime was constant throughout, but the economic system changed. The economic system changed at a point at which 88.3% of the Chinese people in 1981 lived in extreme poverty, and now less than 1% do. 878 million Chinese lived in general poverty, and now less than 10 million do. And the answer to that was the release of human economic energy through the adoption of capital principles of private sector economies. There is no doubt that private sector individual economies have produced far more wealth than socialist central planning has ever produced. Take North Korea and South Korea. Per capita income in South Korea, 28,000. Per capita income in North Korea, $583. The historical record is absolutely clear. Now, can capitalism do better? It certainly can. And capitalism is beginning to change its orientation from shareholder capitalism, which stressed short-term results and quarterly statements, to stakeholder capitalism. The Business Roundtable just adopted in August a new approach to corporate governance, listing five things. The last was the shareholders' interest. The first was customers. The second was workers. The third was suppliers. The fourth was the community. And the fifth was shareholders. Building on stakeholder capitalism and maximizing, you know, the American workforce has changed so dramatically. In 1900, it was primarily male, industrial, agricultural, unskilled.
10 seconds.
Today, it's professional, women, older people, younger people, science and education. Building on that, the capitalist future in this country is bright, and socialism is not a credible alternative.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Call upon the first speaker for socialism for his rebuttal.
I have to admit to being really surprised to hear China being held up as the miracle of capitalist growth when most people recognize it as a brutal totalitarian society where there is no freedom. I mean, just look at what's happening in Hong Kong. And so to criticize socialism on the one hand for restricting our freedom, but then to praise China's move toward capitalism while they still hold on to a totalitarian society, I find to be revealing of some real contradictions. Now, often we hear that socialism is good in theory, but not in practice. I want to flip that and explain why capitalism is good in theory, but not in practice, with just a few examples. The uber capitalist and business guru, Peter Drucker, has said, if you find an executive who wants to take on social responsibilities, fire him, fast. George Soros, the anti-communist billionaire, has said, although I made a fortune in the financial markets, I now fear that the untrammeled intensification of laissez-faire capitalism and the spread of market values into all areas of life is endangering our open and democratic society. The main enemy of the open society, I believe, is no longer the communist, but the capitalist threat. That's a billionaire, someone who's an anti-communist. Reflecting on his reactions, his own reactions to 9/11, a Wall Street commodities broker named Carlton Broker said, when the airplanes hit the towers, the first thing you thought about was, how much is gold up? In the next couple of days, everyone doubled their money. It was a blessing in disguise. He's talking about 9/11. Devastating, crushing, heart-shattering. But for my clients, they all made money. 1 minute. In devastation, there is opportunity. It's all about creating wealth. Think about that for just a minute. In devastation, there is opportunity. This is really existing capitalism, not the fairy tale version of capitalism that we have often heard. We have to look at the way that capitalist societies have destroyed humans, have destroyed the environment, have torn families apart, and now are leading us to perhaps the greatest devastation in the history of the world, a sixth extinction and climate change that is irreversible. That is because of overproduction, overconsumption, the notion of infinite growth, which is a demand of capitalism, but which our finite planet cannot withstand. We need collective action if we are going to turn the tide on climate change. And the one thing that capitalists hate hearing is the idea that people are going to take collective action.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Call upon the second speaker for capitalism for his rebuttal.
Let me make a couple of points. Bill mentioned that capitalism induces pollution and causes environmental damage. But think about the evidence. What are the most polluted cities in the world in terms, based on the World Bank statistics, in terms of the carbon dioxide particles per square meter, which they usually take such a measure. It is Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia, which is certainly not a capitalist country, then New Delhi, India, and a range of cities which are run by bureaucrats regulatory agencies, etc. The cleanest cities, the countries which care about the environment, are those capitalist countries such as Germany, Switzerland, in particular the whole Paris Accord. So I would downplay this argument. Next point, China. Look, under Mao Zedong, it was an extreme socialist or demagogic regime that tried to impose uniform values on everything. You are not supposed to dress differently from your peers, etc. You could only get a portion of income designated to you by the government. Then Deng Xiaoping, deputy to Mao Zedong, traveled to Singapore and recognized that free market forces and a high degree of competition can work and do wonderful things in China. Milton Friedman, who had advised Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore, subsequently advised Deng Xiaoping how to introduce a free market capitalist system in China. And if you traveled in China, you would recognize immediately freedom of businesses everywhere, negotiating prices everywhere. The central communist government cannot regulate these numerous private initiatives and businesses. So I wanted to make this point. One more point, just bring up for a discussion. Please remember that tariffs, trade wars, are not capitalist tools. They are inconsistent with freedom of choice and free market precepts of capitalism.
Thank you very much. We'll call upon now the second speaker for socialism for her rebuttal.
Hi. I would just like to point out that capitalism is an economic system. Fascism is a political system, as socialism is an economic system. And there's a tendency to equate the two. And because of that home field advantage that I talked about, it's a really easy argument, right? Because if you start adopting socialist policies such as universal healthcare and free college, who knows? You might get a narcissistic demagogue who takes over the country. Who knows, right? Because it's a possible loom, a possible threat, right? You might end up in a dictatorship. And ultimately, because we don't know. And there's a tendency to conflate the political system with the economic system. And capitalist countries have committed atrocities over and over and over again. Right. So there's a difference between your political system and your economic system. And to the point that my colleague made before, our economic system is not functioning as a democracy right now because of corporate power. And I imagine that that's something that most of us have to agree on, whether you're on the right or the left. When we are looking at corporate policy, so there was this famous day in 2005, right, where they started the rollback of the estate tax, and on the same day, they made it more difficult for low-income families to be able to claim bankruptcy because they wanted people to be held to their debt. But not the estate tax. Does everybody know what the estate tax is? Right? So when you think about how our political system is working for us, the average senator has $10 million of wealth. The average person in the House of Representatives has $5 million in wealth. These are folks making economic policy that do not represent your interests. I hope that's you. I want it for you. I do, right? But that might not be us at this moment. But that's not the majority of us. And as my colleagues say, there is a lot of wealth in this country, actually about $98 trillion, okay? It's a lot of money, right? But so let me just kind of check my math here. So if you were to take that $98 trillion and you were to distribute that, this is a really amazing quality of life, right? This is about $1.4 million of wealth for a family of four. But that wealth is not distributed equally. When we talk about individual choice, we assume that people are not in poverty. So here's the thing, when we talk about individual freedom under capitalism, it is only people who the system is working for that experience that individual freedom. Because that wealth is not evenly distributed. I'm not actually even saying it should be.
I'm just saying it's so egregiously distributed right now that, in fact, right now the wealth of the middle class has actually been steadily declining since 1995. And in fact, the top 1% actually holds more wealth than the entire middle class. And we define the middle class by the middle 60% of the quintiles. So I'm not even saying more than poor people. I'm saying more than the entire middle class. So this notion of individual freedom promised by capitalism is a misnomer because we pretend there's no poor people. Because poor people don't experience individual freedom. They don't experience basic rights, basic safety, basic access to healthcare.
Okay, thank you very much. So we now turn to the audience portion of this debate, and we do have some time for questions. Please note that we would appreciate it if you ask a question rather than make statements. And we would also like to rotate the questions between the two sets of debaters. So for the first question, Professor Higgins will have the microphone and he will circulate with it. Who would like to ask a question? And if you could rise, please, when you speak.
Good evening. My question is for the capitalist side. I'd just like for either of you to address free labor and what was established in the capitalistic system, whether you're talking about slavery or taking land from the natives or the indigenous peoples, and how that was established and how that has affected us even now and in the future. So if anyone could just address free labor, I'd appreciate that.
Okay. Well, the microphone will come back up.
Yep.
There we go.
You know, the problems of slavery and the problems of Native Americans and their land, I don't know, you know, those are grievous problems, grievous wounds in American history, scars in American history. I don't know if they're directly attributable to capitalism, which has really stressed free labor, certainly much more than socialist regimes. But those were, you know, significant problems. I would say that, you know, the problems of slavery, the problems of Native Americans are blights on the American past, but I think there's a lot more in American history that explains them than just the capitalism versus socialism.
Please remember also that capitalism has evolved. I tend to agree with you that the 19th century capitalism was really based on exploitation of slaves, workers. You know, the average number of working hours per week back in 1870 was 72, believe it or not. Now it's around 40. And it was the time where Karl Marx conducted his analysis and a very insightful analysis, after all, of the 19th century capitalism. Right, but this has evolved into a more democratic society. Yet the whole process is not over. You know, capitalism needs to evolve more, and I agree with Amanda about that division between the political sphere and the economic regulation sphere.
Okay. Another question?
For the socialist side.
For the socialists. Okay.
So my question is for the socialists, and my question is, you guys keep talking about wealth, but what type of wealth are you talking about redistributing? Is it liquid cash? Is it assets like a boat or a yacht? What wealth is it?
Start there?
Sure.
So this is actually a really interesting question. When you look at kind of some of these democratic socialist policies and how we would tax wealth, I mean, generally wealth has a definition of all of your assets minus your debt, right? So that's a pretty straightforward definition. But one of the kind of, so I'm actually going to say something else kind of in reference to your question. One of the things that comes up a lot when we talk about taxing the uber wealthy is how difficult it would be to impose, or to enforce actually is the word. So people talk a lot about tax evasion and tax avoidance. And boy, wouldn't it be nice to live in a world where the federal government was so concerned about you breaking the law that they bothered not to make ones that you might break, right?
Because tax evasion is a crime, and we could hold people accountable to it. So that's when it gets to this question of boats, of liquid assets, right? And is that how do you actually tax those things? But in many regards, we're not even really willing to take a chance to try because of this fear of tax evasion and difficulty of tax avoidance.
1 minute.
And I totally understand where that question is coming from, and it makes perfect sense. So let me just say this quickly. Socialism does not mean you would not be able to own your own house or car or smartphone.
Or jet. Jet, maybe.
Or that I would show up in the middle of the night and eat that enchilada that you've been saving for breakfast. That's not what socialism is. Socialism is not about a world without personal property. It's about a world where the things that give those who have power over others would be communal. Things like natural resources, utilities, infrastructure. So, for example, instead of going to a job where you work all day for minimum wage, while the owners and shareholders get the wealth from your labor, what if you and the other people who work there were all owners? You all owned the factory, you all owned the warehouse, you all owned the store. What if all the profits were divided up instead of just going to Jeff Bezos?
Okay, we're alternating between socialism and capitalism, so the question now should focus on the capitalist side of the panel.
Can I jump into
the same question? That was our question.
Otherwise it gets out of control. Yeah. Capitalist side now? Yes.
So the point was made really about this idea of overproduction and scarcity of resources. And I'm curious from the capitalist perspective, I think very often what we see is free markets don't often price things correctly, and they exploit things and don't take into account environmental pollution and things like that they're forced to price into their goods. So from your perspective, how can a free market society without over-regulation really tackle those sorts of issues that are prevalent today?
One point is what you're talking about is the externalization of costs onto society. You're talking about the externalization of costs onto the environment or onto society. I think that one answer to that is something I alluded to a few moments ago, the difference between shareholder-driven capitalism and stakeholder-driven capitalism. Shareholder capitalism came into heavy vogue in the 1960s, associated with Milton Friedman. It's the notion that the managers of a concern, of a company, their only obligation is to maximize shareholder wealth. So if your only obligation is to maximize shareholder wealth, that leads to a lot of externalities, a lot of social problems. Coming into vogue again today is something called stakeholder capitalism, where capitalism has to recognize all the stakeholders in the society, that there are workers, the community, the suppliers, the customers, and that capitalism has to orient itself in a way to measuring progress and profits to take all those four or five into account. And indeed, the Business Roundtable just produced new guidance on corporate governance, which said that the number one concern is customers, number two concern is workers, number three concern is suppliers, communities, number four concern is suppliers, and number five is shareholders. So that offers a way toward a more comprehensive view of what is wealth and how is it maximized and what are its costs and what should be the allocations that are necessary to protect society and workers and customers from exploitative capitalism.
I do agree that a free market system sometimes leads to imperfect pricing of goods and services due to imperfect information or adverse selection or moral hazard problems. But what are the alternatives? The proponents of socialist, centrally planned economy tried to do that. Take, for instance, Oscar Lange promoting gathering huge data in the economy and optimizing the data about prices via a large computer system. Well, that was advocated by Lange and subsequently an architect of central planning back in the 1950s, and it didn't work out very well. Second point, the capitalist system yields a Pareto first best optimum under free market conditions. The proponents of socialism or the critics of capitalism propose some alternatives. Lipsey, Lancaster, Harry Johnson proposed the second best optimum that could be reached with tariffs, for instance. And that didn't work out. Nobody remembers these lofty ideas from the 1970s, and nobody makes any references to the second best optimum. The first best optimum is a Pareto optimum reached within a market system, which sometimes may malfunction.
Okay, a question now to the socialist panel, please. I will allow you both to answer in this case, to be in fairness, balance here.
Good evening, Michael Hurley. You were pretty critical earlier of the policies of the Trump administration as it relates to tax policy and the effects on workers. But if you look at the growth in real wages, particularly growth in real wages for the bottom 25% of workers, they've been particularly strong, if not some of the best increases that we've seen in decades. So clearly the president's policies must be doing something right for workers, particularly workers on the lower end. I was hoping you could comment on that.
I would love to. And I just want to clarify, I actually did not say anything about President Trump, but I did reference the recent tax policy that was a function of our current government, yes. Okay. But yes, I mean, wages have gone up, and it looks like they've gone up almost 3% this year. We're almost at before recession numbers, or we're about hitting before recession numbers. The middle class has not yet recovered from the recession. The top 1% has, in fact, recovered, if you look at the numbers, but we're getting there. And we do see upward mobility, and I don't think anybody's arguing that you aren't seeing that upward mobility, but what you do have to put in context is 2 to 3%, you know, looks like $240 rise in actual take-home pay for some of these folks that we're mentioning, right? So when you're looking at how much wealth we're actually pocketing, they're just not comparable, right? So it's not to say that wages aren't rising. They are, but when wages rise by 2 to 3%, and you're comparing that to the billions of dollars pocketed by those corporate tax cuts, I mean, by those companies, and those numbers are not inflated. They're actually, when you're looking at the amount that that's going to add to our deficit, I'm sure my capitalist friends could even talk about this, right? If we're talking about fiscal responsibility, that new tax law is going to add billions of dollars to our corporate deficit, and in fact, already has this year. So because he agrees, because we've lessened the tax burden, and that's what debt is. Government debt is taxes. Sometimes it's deferred. It's actually being deferred to many of you, right? As that debt service is coming up, right? But that's what debt is. It's taxes. It might be deferred, but it's taxes, right? So ultimately, yes. I mean, we have cut taxes, but we have increased that debt burden. We have seen an increase in wages, but it's not an increase enough where people are actually experiencing a rise in their quality of life.
In my hand, I'm holding an analysis that was published in June 2019. It says the top 1% gained $21 trillion in wealth since 1989, while the bottom half lost $900 billion. It goes on to say the three wealthiest people in America have as much wealth as the bottom 50%. The three people as much as the bottom 50%. 650 of our children die every hour on the planet from starvation. Under 10 people have the same wealth as 3 billion of us. We're all aware of how little fast food workers are paid in comparison to the enormous profits of the chains. McDonald's makes a profit, made a profit of $5 billion in 2018. If you have any doubt that corporations want to pay their labor force as little as possible, ask yourself why it is that the most lucrative corporations now rely on young labor forces in Asia, South America, and Africa instead of in the US. In addition to being able to pay those workers less, globalization of the sort that we talk about in terms of the miracles of growth and the miracles of capitalism, allow them to avoid pesky laws about safe and humane working conditions, about pollution, about environmental destruction. Let's be very clear. The wealth at the top of the economic skyscrapers are more than we can possibly imagine, and it's not wealth that they've built all by themselves. They've built it on the labor of others who are dying of starvation.
All right, we have two questions left now from the floor. What, the first to the capitalist panel and the second to the socialist panel. And then we will go to the summing up, okay? So, yes. There was somebody at the back, but was that for the capitalist panel or for the, pardon?
No.
For the, okay.
Hi, Matteo. So most of the pollution produced around the world comes from the United States and China, respectively. So my question is, how do you explain how the two largest producers in the world cause the overwhelming amount of pollution? And how would you answer a capitalist solution to that then?
Well, I think that the capitalist solution to the problem of pollution and global warming is innovation. It's certainly not socialism. The answer is innovation. Let me give you one example. The opportunities from the greening of America, the greening of the planet, are tremendous, both with respect to environmental impact and economic impact. Trillions of dollars to be made, trillions of jobs. And it depends on technological breakthrough, which has always been the foundation of capitalism. If we could figure out economically how to store and transmit solar energy, that would be transformative of the planet. The United States and China are probably the biggest polluters because they're probably the biggest industrial producers. You know, they go hand in hand. But capitalism has never been revanchist capitalism. It has always looked to the future, not to the past. Capitalism does not look to coal. It looks to the sun. There's tremendous strides that can be made, economic and environmental opportunities, if we just allow what are our strengths, which are education, science, technology, and freedom, to just unleash an assault on the problems of the warming planet. A capitalist assault.
This was really that nicely phrased. I'm tempted to discuss the issue of income inequality, which Amanda has brought up. And socialism, but the old one, the one relying on central planning and central distribution of income, really led to deep shortages of goods. So only those who formed elites had access to these goods, and the rest of the society lived under poverty conditions. Do we call it an equitable income distribution? And look at the countries which are reporting the highest degrees of inequity in income distribution by the Lorenz curve or Gini coefficient. Those are Brazil, Peru, and Russia, you know, as a result of dictatorial bureaucrats and Russia improper and highly corrupt privatization. Most equitable societies are these modern, you know, welfare states, Sweden and the Scandinavian countries, and mother. No, but that's the evidence, that's a reality. So I'm pointing out that socialism really does not produce that. equitable income distribution. And on tax cuts, we had to cut taxes. Our corporate profit tax before the recent round of tax cuts was close to 40%. Now it's 21% because everybody else was cutting taxes and we were losing direct investment and so-called transfer pricing elsewhere. So incomes were flying out of the United States. I think the Mnuchin and the administration got it right at 21%. That's a revenue optimizing level of taxes. The problem is with overspending, not with tax revenues.
Okay, for the final question then to the socialist panel, and then we will move to the summary here, okay?
How are you guys doing? So first, a little background. When I was little, I was always raised that if you don't like something or something upsets you about the way something is being done, instead of just saying, I don't like it, and making a scene, my dad used to tell me, sit down, think about it, come up with a better solution to fix the things you don't like, and then present your idea. So sitting here tonight, I've noticed that you guys have been saying a lot of stuff about this is why capitalism is bad, socialism will fix this, what have you, okay? So I'm gonna bring up a program that I'm sure you guys support, which is socialized medicine. I would assume you guys support that, right? Well, I got out of the military in 2016. Well, when I got out, I had 3 degenerative discs in my back. A lot of pain. I did not realize I had this, and I was not diagnosed with this until a year later. And it took another 6 months on top of that to even get treatment for that. Okay? So that's one socialist program. And that's for 7.5% of the population. So how do you expect me to believe that you can, implementing a socialist government, that we can somehow fix everything wrong with not only the VA, but now expand that to the entire population, and then do that for all aspects of life, not just the medical field?
Well, first of all, I want to say it's terrible that you haven't been able to get the help that you've needed. But I think it's also important to point out that what we really have in the U.S., even for veterans, is not really socialized medicine, because it's still under the control of the private companies that run the health industry. What we really need is not socialized health insurance, which I think is what you're talking about, but free medical care for all, where you would be able to get the medical care that you need without having to go through either private or government insurance. Then you would really be able to get that attention rather than having to go through either the private insurance companies, which are still completely in bed. Let's be very clear. The Affordable Care Act did not turn us into a socialized medicine country. That was an act that was given over to the private healthcare industries. They embraced it. They loved it because it was increased their profits. It was a program that was originally introduced by Mitt Romney, the Republican governor of Massachusetts. So what we really need is that healthcare, education, and other essential goods are a right, not something that is only for a select group who can afford to be a part of these programs.
I couldn't agree more. So thank you for your service to start with. And also to say that, I mean, part of our abuse of veterans when they return is actually trying to support veterans in a for-profit system. And this is the thing. I mean, when we talk about capitalism, it just really misses that human element, right? What does it mean to support people? Right? What does it mean to ensure human dignity? What do we think needs to be guaranteed as human dignity? Right? What do we think composes human dignity? And we're not going to agree on those things, right? So for me, access to food, I believe, is central to human dignity. I do. I think that access to food for all children is central to human dignity. I feel like I probably have some people in the room who agree. Okay? But at the same time, there's a lot of political support for rolling back food stamp programs, right? We've already dismantled our welfare system, right, and replaced it with TANF, right? So I think this example of healthcare that you bring up is one of just many where human dignity is being violated by for-profit systems. Now, that's not to say, and I think it's really, when we talk about capitalism, I don't think that folks who are democratic socialists, and I think it's worthwhile to differentiate that term, but I don't think that folks who are democratic socialists are necessarily saying are saying capitalism should not have happened. Rather, what they're saying is the next stage of capitalism is a more democratically socialist environment. And that's for a number of reasons, right? A, it's not working for the next generation. Some of the numbers I gave you already. And I'm really excited to hear what politicians' answers are to young people, right? Because young people are posing these questions and they're demanding answers. And the problem that politicians have right now is they keep answering with systems that work for them while being totally out of touch with what young people need. Young people are increasingly concerned about climate change, and that is already a human dignity issue and will become much more so over the course of our lives, as things like, for instance, access to water become immediate concerns for people. So I think that comment is actually great, and I think in many regards it's actually a really strong argument for some socialist democratic policies that my colleague over here helped me out and mentioned in some of these Scandinavian countries that have much better equity indexes than we do. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. We will now turn to the closing arguments, and I would ask each debater to once again approach the podium for their closing statement, not to exceed 2 minutes. And I'd like to now call upon the first speaker for capitalism.
Well, I'm glad all four of us agree that the future still is capitalism, because socialism is social property, not individual property, central planning, not individual decision making. I fully concur that what we are witnessing is the next wave, the evolution of capitalism and the free enterprise system. It's a shame to me that capitalism is now the bad guys and socialism the good guys, because capitalism has been so instrumental in the story of human freedom, and socialism as practiced, not just in theory, but as practiced, wherever it has been practiced, in the Soviet Union, in China, in North Korea, in Cuba, has led to the diminution of freedom, not its expansion. I want to take you back for 1 minute to the world before capitalism, to the feudal order of things, when your birth, your rank, your parentage, your lineage determined your possibilities, where the arc of your destiny favored those who were royal or noble or aristocratic, not you. Capitalism unhinged that whole world and allowed freedom to blossom, opportunity to blossom, wealth to be made. It made money a good thing, not a bad thing. Because money doesn't ask questions about where you were born, what your rank is, who your parents are, what your lineage is. Money is egalitarian. Money is democratic. That's why Friedrich Hayek said that money is the greatest instrument of freedom ever invented by man, because all men can accumulate, not only those of certain birth or certain rank or certain religion. And that's why Marx was wrong to denigrate the cash nexus and instead to romanticize feudal ties of sentiment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Call upon the first speaker for socialism to bring closure.
So, like I mentioned in my last comment, I agree with my colleagues about a lot of things, actually. I agree that the solutions to climate change, if we have them still, are going to be innovation and technological breakthrough. I look forward to a world where everybody was invited to that table and where those innovations and those technological breakthroughs happen, because everybody has been given equal access to education and higher ed so that those folks who have the best answers are at the table and not just the folks who had the money to get to that place.
These are the compelling reasons why, for instance, our young people are attracted to things such as free college. And I realize I stand on a college campus while I say this. And this is what's actually really appealing to me about working at Sacred Heart University, because the difference between us as a nonprofit and a corporation is that we are all agreed upon the primary reason we're here, and that's students. They're the reason for the season. We don't have to think about profit, right? But in a corporation, you do. And to Bert's point, I mean, to rely on the benevolent goodness of wealthy people to make decisions for the rest of us has not always worked. It has worked, well, but to think that these would be the solutions, right? That if there was technology that could address climate change, that technology wouldn't be privatized and used for profit, right? People are already buying water rights with the knowledge that our water industry will probably privatize even more so than now in the near future. We have to answer some very difficult questions in the next 10 years or so. Some scientists tell us 12 years. And in fact, I would actually argue, I had lunch with a biologist today, and I was talking to him about the way in which climate change kind of factors into this debate. And he made this really great point. He said, you know, I'd almost be more comfortable if the free market was actually working. But in fact, when you look at solutions to climate change, the free market is not being allowed to operate. Because I agree with my colleagues, wind, solar, these are the future. And those propositions are being actively knocked down time and time again over political, corporate interests in fossil fuels. Because that is not the market working. Right? Those are people making political decisions to reinforce existing structures of wealth rather than try out new systems. And if the market was actually working, who knows? Maybe. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Call upon the second member of the capitalist team for closing arguments.
Several points I'd like to make. Capitalism is an evolving system which is now modified to take into consideration human dignity, protection of marginalized people, and I agree with Amanda, provide equal access to education. And Sacred Heart University may not know this, but has been very much a part of it. That was the reason why Bishop Curtis established the university, to give access to education to mostly immigrant families in the greater Bridgeport area, whose children were the first ones actually attending university. Gary remembers it, so do I, from the early years. So we have mastered teaching at Sacred Heart University to make it communicative and productive to these immigrant first generation students. But don't destroy capitalist precepts on the way of its modification. You have to give a chance to entrepreneurs to grow. Those so-called 100% billionaires, do you really want to bankrupt Jeff Bezos? You know, do you really think that Jeff Bezos is preoccupied with his money? No, I would rather focus on how many jobs Mr. Bezos and Amazon has created and how much innovation they have introduced in the economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Call upon the second member of the socialist side.
I got all worked up tonight. Look, that's just how I am. I'm a pugilist. I actually respect everyone up here completely. I respect their intentions, their good intentions, even if they're wrong. As Tara Eagleton says, you know that capitalism is in trouble when people have to start defending capitalism. Because for decades, we've taken it for granted that it's just common sense, as natural as the air we breathe. But the air we breathe is now in trouble, and so is capitalism. Many of the social gains that we now take for granted were advanced and fought for by socialists. So here is where I defend socialism rather than attacking capitalism. Who amongst us would object to the 40-hour work week, a decent wage for hard work, laws against child labor, free public K through 12 schools, the ability for all adult citizens to vote, civil rights, racial equality, benefits for those who lose their jobs or become disabled through no fault of their own, Social Security and Medicare for the elderly. All of those were consistently fought for by socialists and fought against by those who saw that as a threat to our freedom. Because we're at Sacred Heart University, I want to end with this. Some people think that Jesus was the first socialist. I don't know if I would make that argument. I don't want to get in trouble. I'm not a theological scholar. But I will end with this quote from Jose Mina, writing in the Catholic Herald. Leo XIII teaches of the primacy of the common good and of the subjection of all rights and liberties to it. St. Thomas Aquinas teaches of the universal destination of goods, that my excess directly belongs by right to those who are in severe need of it. Pope St. John Paul II teaches of a just wage for honest work capable of supporting a family. Pope Pius XI teaches that labor should not be bought and sold on a market as if it were a commodity. Pope St. Paul VI teaches of the positive role of public authority in expropriating private property where it's injurious to the common good. Pope St. John the 23rd teaches that the rights of man include the basic necessities of life independent of anyone's ability to secure these through labor. And I haven't even mention Pope Francis yet. That's my quote, not his. Is this not socialism? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much to our four debaters. Professor Higgins will now give his closing statement concerning this forum. Thank you.
You know, ideas generate fire and they generate passion. And ideas are best refined. Sorry, a listening voice.
We are not, Michael.
All right, sit down. Sit down.
We're too busy.
Ideas are best refined in the forge of debate. And ideas are elastic things. They survive in a climate that allows them to breathe. What we have done tonight is to allow them the oxygen that they require. It's possible that perhaps you've changed your view tonight on something. It's become more nuanced. You've moved to a different perspective. If that's the case, that's wonderful. Because ideas, when we hear them articulated, sometimes, indeed always, with our four debaters tonight, with integrity and with aggressive intellectual interest, we can change our minds. It's good to change our minds. That's what universities do. They help us change our minds. They help to form our minds. So let's once more thank the four debaters for tonight's. The committee that puts this together consists of Dr. Michelle Loris, Vice President Mike Iannazzi, Professor James Castengay, Professor Gary Rose, and myself, Michael W. Higgins. If you have any ideas or suggestions for what we should do for next year's debate, please approach any one of us. Good night, and thank you for showing.
Thank you.